After 2 empty years of searching, the appearance of the eagle startled John James Audubon. Audubon was strolling along a road in Kentucky to visit a friend. 100 yards ahead sat a pen where the friend slaughtered hogs and dumped their organs. You can imagine how pungent it smelled. Suddenly, Audubon heard wings fluttering. An eagle who had been snacking on hog guts shot up from the pen and perched on a branch overhead. Audubon could barely believe his eyes. This was not a bald eagle. It was the bird of Washington, a far rarer species. Audubon had glimpsed the bird just twice before. The second time, he'd spied a nest on a cliff with 2 parents and 2 chicks. He had tried to shoot one to collect it, but a sudden storm had thwarted him. Now he had another chance. Quietly, he withdrew a rifle from his pack and crept forward. He later swore that the eagle saw him approach and stared right back at him, undaunted. Audubon raised his rifle, stilled his breath, and fired. The bird was dead before it hit the ground. Audubon raced up, giddy. The eagle was beautiful, with a 10-foot wingspan. And while he had no way of knowing it, this specimen would prove to be the most important one he ever collected. It would salvage his career at its darkest moment and win him international fame. In fact, without the Bird of Washington, no one today would know who John James Audubon, the most famous naturalist in American history, even was. From the Science History Institute, this is Sam Keen and the Disappearing Spoon, a topsy-turvy, science-y history podcast, where footnotes become the real story. According to his autobiography, Audubon was born in New Orleans in 1785, the son of a sea captain. He spent his childhood in France. There, he picked up painting and trained under the famous French artist Jacques-Louis David. When Audubon was 18, his father summoned him back to America to manage a family plantation near Philadelphia. Audubon quickly ran it into the ground. He had no mind for business. Instead, he spent his days tramping about the woods, looking for birds. He was obsessed with them. Songbirds, hawks, waterfowl, anything with feathers fascinated him. So much so that he had to possess them. It's a paradox, but the great bird lover Audubon was also a prolific bird killer. He shot thousands of them. Afterward, he would usually sketch the bird, then eat it. If he was out in the woods, he roasted them over a fire, sometimes with a sprinkling of gunpowder for seasoning. Other birds he brought home to make bizarre dishes: blackbird pot pie, owl gumbo, sautéed flamingo tongue. With his best specimens, Audubon painted them, usually in watercolors. He'd hang them from wires or pin them to a board in a lifelike position. It could take days before he finished. Sometimes the birds started rotting, but Audubon kept painting until he was satisfied. Still, Audubon longed to be more than an artist. He wanted to make his name as a scientist, too. And in 1804, he came up with his first experiment. It involved the pee-wee flycatcher, also known as the eastern phoebe. It's a tiny, plump bird with a white chest and gray body. It looks like it has a sunflower seed for a bill. Audubon was trudging along a creek one spring day when he came across a cave. Inside, he found a pee-wee flycatcher nest with 5 chicks. A question occurred to him. That coming winter, the birds would migrate south, then return to Pennsylvania the next spring to mate. But where exactly would they return? To this creek? Even this cave? Or would they go somewhere else? This habit of returning to your birth home to breed is called natal philopatry. It's common in salmon and sea turtles. But does it happen with birds? Audubon devised a way to test this. He snuck up to the flycatcher nest and tied a silver thread to the leg of each chick. He could then return next spring. If he found any flycatchers with silver threads, that meant the original birds had returned. This type of study, where you catch, band, release, and track animals, is now standard in ecology, thanks to Audubon. To be sure, his experiment did not go very smoothly. The wily flycatchers kept unknotting his threads and dumping them, but they eventually got used to them and stopped bothering. 6 months later, the trees erupted in gold and red. The flycatchers took off south. Audubon spent an anxious winter waiting. He hurried back to the cave as soon as the weather allowed. Lo and behold, he found two flycatchers nearby with silver threads. 40% had returned. It was a thrilling discovery for the teenager. Smart, original research. Except it was probably wrong. According to Audubon's own account, he personally observed the return of the banded flycatchers in spring 1805. More specifically, another local birder recorded the flycatchers returning on March 7th. But according to historical documents, Audubon actually left home to visit France on February 28th, a week earlier. He wasn't even in Pennsylvania when the birds returned. He could not have personally observed anything. Now, perhaps someone else noticed the banded flycatchers and told Audubon about them. And maybe in writing the results up, Audubon inserted himself into the story for simplicity's sake. Scientific standards were looser then. Except there's another problem. Later, scientists repeated the experiment with larger sample sizes, nearly 12,000 peewee flycatchers. And in this work, less than 2% returned to within even 100 square miles of their birth home. In fact, no study of any related bird has ever recorded rates over 14%. Audubon's 40% therefore seems suspiciously high. And given that Audubon was not even in the country then, you can't help but wonder whether Audubon just made the results up. It's an uncomfortable thought. Audubon is an American icon, and his story about inventing the practice of bird banding is a founding story of American ornithology. The tale still gets repeated today. But it's probably total bunk. The few biographers who have noticed the problems with Audubon's account have explained it away as a forgivable lapse, a young man who simply got too eager, too ambitious. But it's not the last time Audubon would run into trouble. In 1808, Audubon moved to Kentucky. Before long, he devised another ambitious idea. He wanted to package all his wildlife paintings into a book. He would call it Birds of America. It would be like nothing else in science. He wanted to render each bird life-sized, even vultures and turkeys. The book would therefore need to be humongous, which would also make it expensive. To finance it, he would need subscribers to pay for installments before the book was even finished, a risky request. And the more he thought about it, the more doubts began creeping in. Would anyone subscribe? After all, he was just a bumpkin in Kentucky. He also felt self-conscious about his command of English, which was his second language behind French. Could he really pull off such an ambitious book? The person who finally convinced him to try was, of all people, the nephew of Napoleon. Lucien Bonaparte was a noted ornithologist. In 1824, he was living in Philadelphia, the center of American science then. Audubon happened to be visiting Philadelphia himself at the time. As two French speakers obsessed with birds, they naturally hit it off. And when Audubon mentioned his book project, Bonaparte was smitten. He begged Audubon to pursue it. But when Audubon finally worked up the courage to approach some naturalists in Philadelphia, things went south quickly. All due to the machinations of one man, the hated George Ord. Biographies of Audubon are always harsh on Ord. One called him a long-faced, quarrelsome, wealthy dilettante. The odium just drips off the page. Ord was tall and stoop-shouldered, with swirls of white in his black hair. As the son of a prosperous rope merchant in Philadelphia, he had plenty of money to pursue science. He worked on the specimens that Lewis and Clark hauled back from the Louisiana Territory, and he provided the first scientific description of grizzly bears and pronghorns. But Ord's passion was birds. Initially, he collaborated with his mentor, the ornithologist Alexander Wilson. After Wilson died of dysentery in 1813, Ord completed a book that Wilson had started, a book on American birds. You can see the problem. Ord had published a book on birds, a book he had a financial interest in. Then Audubon shows up in Philadelphia with his gorgeous paintings and announces plans to publish an even bigger and better book. It's not hard to imagine Ord feeling threatened. Audubon wanted the prestigious Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia to publish his book. Ord happened to be vice president of the Academy. Not surprisingly, the Academy rejected Audubon's book. And more humiliation was in store. A few Academy members had been wowed by Audubon's watercolors, so they nominated him for membership in July 1824. The full body of members voted on the matter in August. They did so by secret ballot, dropping into a container either a white marble for yes or a black marble for no. I will save you the suspense. The Academy blackballed Audubon. The message was clear. You are not welcome here. This rejection crushed Audubon. He loved America and thought of his book in patriotic terms. It would demonstrate the scientific and artistic might of the young republic. But American science had rejected him, and with no hope of publishing at home, he decided to try England. This was not an easy decision. The thought of leaving America was emotionally wrenching. Audubon also had little money. He would have to leave behind his wife and children to fend for themselves, all for a venture that might flop. He might even get stuck abroad, unable to return. But he felt he had no choice, no other outlet for his ambition. It was England or bust.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight Loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Struggling with weight that doesn't respond to traditional dieting? ProLon's 5-Day Fasting Mimicking Diet is a clinically developed nutrition program designed to promote fat loss while protecting lean body mass. Developed at USC's Longevity Institute, it assists the body in entering a fasting-like state that helps reset metabolism, target visceral fat, and supports healthy metabolic markers. In just 5 days, ProLon offers a structured, science-backed approach to weight loss without extreme restriction or guesswork. Get 15% off plus a $40 bonus gift when you subscribe at prolonlife.com/begin.
Audubon arrived in England with his portfolio of paintings in July 1826, and initially things went well. Within 2 weeks, he staged an exhibition in Liverpool. 400 people crowded in. They marveled at how lifelike his birds looked. Another exhibition followed in Edinburgh. Beyond his paintings, people were equally enamored with Audubon as a person, partly because he played up his backwoods persona. He kept his hair long and wild. He wore a wolfskin coat. At dinner parties, he imitated gobbling turkeys and hooting owls. He told stories about hunting raccoons and holding barbecues on the 4th of July. People lapped it up. Given the splash he made, Audubon secured a publisher straight away, along with an engraver. The engraver performed the critical task of translating Audubon's detailed paintings onto metal plates for printing the book's pages. Before long, Audubon's dream was coming true. After his struggles in America, he could hardly believe it. Then, disaster struck. After just 10 metal plates, his engraver quit. Why isn't clear. The engraver cited a strike among his colorists, the men who added paint to the plates for printing. But some historians suspect other reasons. Despite the splash he made, Audubon still had not secured many subscribers for his expensive book. So perhaps the engraver realized that he was toiling away on a burdensome, time-consuming project that might end up flopping financially. The strike might have been a convenient excuse to cut bait. Once again, Audubon faced ruin. But also once again, Napoleon's nephew saved him. Audubon was in London when the engraver quit. So was Lucien Bonaparte. After hearing of his friend's plight, Bonaparte introduced Audubon to members of the influential Royal Society Scientific Club. Audubon no doubt arrived nervous. Perhaps he donned his wolfskin jacket, or perhaps a somber suit better fit the occasion. Regardless, Audubon spread his paintings out, bit his knuckles, and anxiously studied the faces of the scientists while they studied his work. To his immense relief, they adored the paintings. Especially one painting, the Bird of Washington, the majestic eagle he had shot a decade earlier near the pen full of hog guts. The Bird of Washington resembled a bald eagle, except without any white on its head or tail. Its lower bill was also longer, and the skull flatter. Most significantly, the Bird of Washington was 25% larger. Audubon's painting shows the bird perched on a crag. Its claws look powerful enough to crush the rock they're gripping. Its dark brown wings are crossed behind its back. And just like how the bird had stared down Audubon before he shot it, this one eyes the viewer in profile, its chest thrust out like a soldier's. After watching the Royal Society members gape at the eagle, Audubon made a fateful decision. Given his success at the Society, a new engraver stepped forward, and the first bird Audubon ordered him to engrave was the Bird of Washington. This choice was crucial. Audubon knew that if he did not find more subscribers, and fast, his dream project would fall apart. He therefore needed a magnificent set of prints to entice people, and the Bird of Washington would be the centerpiece of this set. He was gambling his whole future on this eagle. And the gamble paid off. Over the next few months, a few crucial patrons stepped forward, including King George himself. Talk about an endorsement. There's no record of why exactly the eagle appealed to them, but historians have made suggestions. In the European mind, then, America was a vast, wild frontier, and the idea of a giant eagle lurking there must have thrilled them. The bird's name helped as well. Audubon named the Bird of Washington after George Washington, and he did so only after arriving in England, a calculated decision. The United States had recently fought two wars with Great Britain, and somehow this upstart republic had gone toe-to-toe, blow for blow, with the greatest military power in the world. Britain might have whipped Napoleon, but not George Washington. The name commanded respect there. Combine that with the beauty of the painting itself, and the English could not help but marvel at it. Meanwhile, the Royal Society gave Audubon the chance to write an essay for its zoological journal. In it, Audubon described the years of frustration that he endured tracking down this 10-foot-wide bird. How he first saw it soaring overhead on a barge on the Mississippi River. Then, how he missed his chance to shoot one a few years later due to a storm. He finally bagged one near the pig slaughtering shed while walking the forest in Kentucky. This essay marked the first new species Audubon ever described. In addition, a review of Audubon's work appeared alongside the essay. It was written by a revered British ornithologist named William Swainson, and Swainson was rapturous. He wrote, "I have long aimed at that perfection which Mr. Audubon has so fully attained." Swainson also called Audubon a genius and begged others to subscribe. In truth, this review was not quite on the up and up. In exchange for writing it, Audubon promised Swainson a copy of his Birds of America at a steep discount, meaning Audubon essentially bribed him. But the review worked. Subscriptions poured in. At last, Audubon's success was assured. But what Audubon did not tell Swainson, what he didn't tell anyone, was that he had invented the Bird of Washington. As we'll hear next week, the whole saga was an elaborate fraud. This is the Disappearing Spoon podcast, brought to you by the Science History Institute. Be sure to check out their in-depth science history podcast, Distillations. You can find it anywhere you get your podcasts or on their website, distillations.org. You can find more incredible stories in my books or at samkeen.com. You can also book me as a speaker there for your school or event. If you like this podcast, please spread the word and support it at patreon.com/disappearingspoon. You can also get bonus episodes and signed books at Patreon. This episode was written by me, Sam Keen. It was produced by Mariel Carr, Rigoberto Hernandez, and Sarah Kaplan. Our sound design, scoring, and mixing is by Row Home Productions. Row Home's creative director is Alex Lewis. John Myers is Row Home's executive producer. Thanks for listening.
Row Home Productions.